Welcome, and we are here today with Megan Allman, who is with Life Training Institute and also works with Summit Ministries a lot as well, right?
Yeah.
So, been here for 2 days with our Spotlight Life. We do this every fall. We do a Spotlight something, and in the winter we do Spotlight something else, so just to bring in guests and voices outside of our fellowship and tradition, and it's been a wonderful time. So welcome, Megan, to FLBC.
Yeah, I've been having a blast. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Yeah, well, I live in the great state of Colorado right now, but I am a Georgia girl, born and bred in Georgia. We moved to Colorado about 5 years ago because my husband, Tripp, works with Summit full-time, and so that is my involvement with Summit Ministries. I am a faculty member, so I teach regularly, but mostly I live there and cheer everyone on, and you know, with my kids and my dog. But anyway, yeah, we enjoy working with young adults mostly, but Life Training Institute is a pro-life apologetics organization, so we exist to equip mainly the church, but anyone who will have us to present a clear case for the pro-life view and teach people how to talk about it well and think about it well. So yeah, we travel and go where we are called.
And two kids?
Two kids. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son.
And you're a gymnastics family.
We are a family of acrobats.
I didn't know that. I've watched many of your presentations, and it's never occurred to me that here's a gymnast. You look a whole lot like a pro-life apologist.
Well, there we go. No, there's gymnastics. I'm retired.
Yes.
A long time ago. No, I was a University of Georgia gymnast for just a minute, and so go dogs. I'm shameless about that. But yeah, I'm married a gymnast, and our kids are very flippy and climby and twisty and all those things. And so they both did gymnastics for a few years. And now I've got one doing dance and aerial silks, which is that crazy Cirque du Soleil type sport where you're up in the fabrics and twisting and turning. And my son, who just moves with natural grace, but has taken up baseball.
That'll work.
Yeah, it'll work.
Middle infield, maybe that grace. And but anyway, Manitou Springs, Summit Ministry, beautiful place, great ministry. Check it out, and you can Google all these things: Summit Ministries and Life Training Institute. Both great ministries.
So. Yeah, easysummit.org and prolifetraining.com.
Fantastic. And if you could comment a little bit on your time here, time you've had with our students.
Oh, I've had too much fun, really. I've laughed a lot since I've been here, which is interesting because we're talking about really hard things while I'm here, the issue of life and the issue of abortion. Love the students that I've met. I've had so many conversations, and they're from all over, which is fun. It's similar a little bit to what I do, and what I love seeing is the community that they are building while they're here. They're very serious about what they're studying. They want to change the world for the good, and they have these friendships that are so tight already. So it's never really one student I'm talking to. It's a cluster or two that have met a month ago and are best friends already. So yeah, just working with them, seeing them take it in, hearing their questions, it's encouraging to me.
I just had an idea. I think we should probably put together a cohort of students sometime to go do a 2-week session at Summit. I think they'd really enjoy that. And you know, we handle those issues here, but it's when you can do 2 weeks solid like that, and it would be fantastic. So that's good. All right, you gave us a lot of information and coaching on advocacy. But the biggest thing you taught us, I think, is one-minute apologist, pro-life apologist, a syllogism. Mm-hmm. And if you can take one thing from listening to this this brief podcast episode, I'd love for people to take that away. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we'll do just a couple quick things. The syllogism, which is like the word of the day, I told the students, because people hear that word and they're like, what are you about to do? No, the syllogism, just a simple deductive type of argument. You've got two premises that if the premises hold, then they naturally flow into the conclusion. And so the pro-life argument, when you boil it down to its simplest form, the syllogism looks like this. It's premise one. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings. And that's generally where I have some work to do to make a case. But if that premise holds, then the natural conclusion is that abortion is wrong. And so sometimes that's a conversation starter all by itself. Like, hey, I heard this interesting argument. Here's how it goes. What do you think about that? Now, when I'm asked the question, you know, why are you pro-life? Or when it comes to premise two, there is a 1 minute response to that. It takes some work to learn the, you know, the background of it, but you can really just memorize this. Something like, well, I'm pro-life because the science of embryology tells me that from the moment of conception, you, we're living, distinct, and whole human beings. And philosophically, there's no relevant difference between those embryos that we once were and the adults we are today that would justify having taken our lives back then, but not now. So something like that, in a nutshell, will get a conversation going in a good way, a respectful way, in a way that intrigues people.
Very powerful. Mm-hmm. You also last night, and I want to circle back to this. The last press secretary ruined that, so I can't say that anymore. I want to come back to that topic towards the end of this, because there are a number of objections to all of those things.
Absolutely.
You did a great job last night, or yesterday, I guess it was, during the day, of demonstrating how all of these objections, they're kind of the same thing. And you could answer them with a number of observations that it doesn't really take away from the core argument. This is a human being, and you know, what gives us the ability or the right, mm-hmm. or why would it be a good thing virtuously mm-hmm. to take this life? So we'll come back to that in a little bit. You did a really good job this week of teaching us a loving response, and one thing that you said that stuck with me was all of these reasons for or positions people hold about abortion, none of them are setting out ahead of time to be mean, vile, evil, you know, things like that. I may think of a pro-abortion arguer, that right. this is a mean, vile, evil person, even though what they're doing is mean and vile and evil.
Yeah.
It's very easy for me to say, oh, that baby killer. And believe me, I've said it. So, at least in my head. But you advocate for having a loving, personal conversation with people rather than being a yard sign poster or keyboard warrior. Not that yard signs are and keyboards are wrong.
No.
But why is that? Tell us about your approach a little bit.
Yeah, no, I have friends who have the signs and the stickers and sure. and are doing wonderful job advocating for life online. It's just not the route that I have time for this season mm-hmm. of life. No, I think that what we have to remember is people are people. We're surrounded by them all the time. And generally, people want to lead good lives. They want to do good things. Of course, the whole worldview question is, how are we defining that good? But yeah, I think that when we're talking to the people around us, we have to remember the things that the pro-life view teaches us, and that is our intrinsic worth. We can talk about that more in a minute. You know, we're not valued based on our functions. And when we define any human group by their functions and then link that to their value or their rights-bearing status, we run into problems. This is true of abortion, but it's also true of many other injustices that we see these days. And so we have to remember that the people we're talking to are also intrinsically valuable in the same way. And if we treat them differently, then we're the ones being inconsistent.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so Matthew 5, 21 through 26. I happen to be preaching on that this coming week. I was asked for chapel and then speaking at a Lutherans for Life National Conference, and they wanted me to speak on that. And so I'm thinking, well, here it is. Okay, so how... But when we hear, you've heard it said, do not commit murder, but I say to you, and then Jesus raises that bar.
Yeah.
Sometimes on a Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, we walk away congratulating ourselves because we're against abortion, and we don't kill babies like those other people, and we would never do that. Mm. But really, that commandment is there for us, too, is how have we denigrated human life? How have we lessened human life? And if our response to the pro-abortion arguer it diminishes their human beingness, then, you know, we've done something wrong. So
yeah,
that's good.
I think that's very applicable. That Sermon on the Mount is tricky stuff, right?
Isn't
because
it?
He just fulfills all of it.
Yeah.
And you're going, oh, wait, I need help with that.
Oh, that's good. Well, you did a very good job of that. And I think it also provides an entrance to the heart of the listener if they might disagree with you. So,
and
I'm not sure that we're a really totally safe place to disagree. If you're a pro-choice leaning student who comes here for some reason, it's pretty obvious where we stand on some things. And so being able to have that conversation, I think, helps them process some of these thoughts they've picked up from our culture.
Sure. Well, that's, I mean, we run into that anywhere. And even with the students here, there are a handful who have heard enough from the culture, and because of the deep compassion that they feel for those who are suffering, this is really hard. There's nothing really easy in the conversations about abortion. And so the questions that have come out have been great ones to be willing even to take the time to wrestle through for those students who may have come in just because of recent months and gone, I don't really know where I stand on the issue right now. It takes courage to listen to something like what we were presenting and talking about and working through, because it takes patience and the hard work of looking at more of the nuance of the conversation and not just the extremes.
Great. In our pre-production meeting, Luke mentioned that he really liked your answer to how to have a conversation with a pregnant teen friend.
Yeah.
Of course, our students are 18, 19, 20 years old, so they probably have a pregnant teen friend. How do you have that conversation? Could you repeat what you said last night to our students?
Yeah, I'll try. I think that what the main point I was trying to make is, I don't have a script, right?
Yeah,
we want to
sure.
know, what do I say in this situation? And isn't that the apologetics for those who are interested? They want to know, what do I say? And I think it's more artful than that, because individual circumstances apply. But with your friend, because you already have a relationship built with your friend knows that you love them and they love you. There's a rapport and a trust there that you don't have to work to build. So it is a little different than talking to a stranger about the same kind of thing. I think when friends find themselves in a situation like this, what I understand from Pregnancy Resource Center counselors, the ones, my heroes, the ones
yeah,
who are
sure.
in the trenches, the number one thing that abortion-minded women say is that they do not have felt support in the situation they are in. And so I think that when someone has a friend, it's important for them to know the arguments, as it were, that we went over yesterday. But more important than that is, not to give your friend all the arguments unless they're asking those questions. If that's the case, answer the questions truthfully. But more than anything, it's, what do you need right now? What would help you feel safe right now? Mm-hmm. To give them the truth in not a way that is, apologizing for it, but they're already a mother at this point, even if they don't feel ready to be one. And just to walk with them, to let them know you're there. I think that that's more important even than the arguments in that moment. And the things that we teach at Life Training Institute are vital in the public square right now. But they're vital for Christians and those who are pro-life, because that stretches beyond the Christian worldview for scientific and philosophical reasons. I think it's important for people to know so that they can be grounded and not be shaken by all the things we're hearing from the world around us. But when it comes to real people walking through something hard, it's, I'm here for you. What
That's
do you
great.
Need? Yeah.
You mentioned Pregnancy Resource Center people being heroes.
Yeah,
same here. And you hear these slurs in our culture about, where are all the Christians doing? And, I've seen them. These are the best people God ever made. These are heroes. And they're all over the sacrificially serving in messy situations. And, that's of all straw men, that's probably the worst pro-choice argument.
Yeah, there's a few, but that one's couldn't be more wrong. I mean, there are people volunteering their time to love women and families who are walking through difficult situations, and not just up to birth, which is also contrary to what we would hear, but after birth, building communities linked with local churches, providing. I read an article by Thaddeus Williams recently in World Magazine. Mm-hmm. It was been a little while ago now. It was during the summer, but it's still very accessible online, called Pro-Life from Womb to Tomb with like the question mark, right? Mm-hmm. Is this the kind of view that we need to look at? And in the article, he did state that demographically, Christians give far more than any other group by way of money and resources and time to these causes. It's just not something that's made very public.
Yes.
Not many people know that Pregnancy Resource Centers, at least as of the last time the numbers came in, outnumbered abortion providers 5-1 in our nation. And that may very well change with all that we're seeing in the landscape, but something to note.
Yeah, it is. So that's Well, there's a lot to say there too, and I'm going to move on. So, it's good stuff. Yesterday, you listed on the whiteboard a whole bunch of reasons for abortion or objections to the pro-life argument.
Right. I didn't list them. That was
the students.
It was the audience.
Yeah,
that,
you wrote them. You were the scribe.
That's right.
Faithful scribe. Can I remember what was on that board? Yeah. But we could recreate that list here easily just from top of mind.
And double it easily.
And double it. But then you listed off five categories of reasoning and how all of these fit into one of or maybe several of these categories. So you don't have to have an answer for everything, if this, then that. But along these lines of thinking, what were those categories of response?
Yeah, we were looking at, in making our case for life, we did it kind of inside out. So we were looking at ways that we're here, that we hear abortion being argued for in our culture at the moment. And so the first way that we looked at was that people tend to confuse moral claims when it comes to abortion in particular with preference claims. And so this the moral relativism that seeps into our understanding of is there really an objective or real right and wrong that we can know? Or is it something that we create for ourselves, either within our respective cultures or individually, which is much more the case in our culture? We tend to hear things like, well, that's true for you. Mm-hmm. We gave a couple of examples where we looked at that in I think there was a clip from the Dr. Phil show. You know, we watched that, and it was just clear as day that that statement was made. And I think the same woman who said that would not say the same thing about something like slavery. She wouldn't say, oh, well, if you think that's when life begins and that abortion needs to be wrong, that's great for you, right? In no way would we frame something like slavery that way. Another moral issue that's much clearer to us. Thankfully.
Or in meme language, you don't like slavery, don't have one.
Yeah, that was Francis Beckwith. So that common slogan, don't like abortion, don't have one. And he said, oh, you don't like slavery, then don't own one. And that brings it into stark clarity that something is amiss. So we talked through that. The second one was that people tend to assume instead of argue. And when I say argue, I'm talking about that syllogism that we presented a little while ago. Because embedded in that second premise that abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings, the students had already heard a scientific argument to really ground the humanity of the unborn and a philosophical argument to demonstrate that there's no difference between a human and a person, or there's no kind of difference in functional value between before and after birth that wouldn't also disqualify whole other groups of humanity from valuable humanity. Mm-hmm. So they'd heard all of that. So here we have the assumption that the unborn are not human beings. And the way that I told the students to remember that is to think of a toddler. We teach this at Life Training Institute. If someone gives you a justification for why abortion should be okay, you should ask yourself, if I replace the unborn child with a two-year-old in this scenario, would this be a good enough reason to take the life of the two-year-old? And if the answer is no, then we understand that the person we're talking to is assuming that the unborn is not human like the two-year-old is human. If that's the case, you can use a toddler as an example. You know, what if we were talking about a two-year-old? Now, the person's going to look at you like you're crazy because obviously two-year-olds are human, but it brings you back to the most important question, what is the unborn, which science does answer, living, distinct, and whole, as I pointed out in that one-minute defense of the pro-life position a minute ago. The third is that people tend to assert instead of argue. So they don't address your syllogism, they don't address your science or your philosophy, but they shout something at you, right? Mm-hmm. Or they'll, my body, my choice, or any of those slogans that we tend to hear. I call it the bumper sticker fallacy. Mm-hmm. So by shouting something at me or saying something quippy, it doesn't do anything to touch the case that I've made. And so you can receive it, you can hear it, but generally a good question will reveal more. Oh, what do you mean by that? Like, mm-hmm. Tell me more about your view, my body, my choice. What does that mean? What kind of choice are we talking about? All right. And then you're in a conversation. The fourth way is that people tend to attack instead of argue. This one is the ad hominem fallacy, the name calling, although it can present itself in more than just name calling. So anytime someone is attacking you by calling you a name or maybe attacking your character by making assumptions about you, like we said a moment ago, where, oh, well, Christians don't do enough about mm-hmm. all these other things, or, the Christians are all about the pro-life position, but only up till birth, they don't care about the children once they're born. Well, these are assumptions about someone's character that may or may not be true. But even if it were true, we pointed out, Even if, you know, the person that they're talking to is a complete jerk and representing Christ in that.
It's like, I'm a jerk, but I'm not the one you're aborting.
You know, so, there you go. But so what bearing does that have on making it okay to intentionally kill innocent human beings through abortion? So attacking doesn't address the syllogism. It's just an attack. So rather than get mad, maybe ask them a question. Well, you just called me ignorant. Well, what do you mean by that? Right.
Yeah.
So and see where it goes.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. Don't,
generally, it means that you're ignorant because you think you're right.
Yeah. So
and you're not allowed to do that.
That's right.
And then the final way there was they confuse functioning as a human with being one. And that's really where the argument is on our landscape more in the philosophical camp. People will use very scientific language. Oh, we don't know when life begins, you know, life in quotation marks there. They're talking about human value. They're saying, oh, well, maybe the science says that it's human. And most informed people on the debate understand what the science says. But they're looking at it and going, well, it might be human, but it's not a person. It's not like you and me. It's not deserving of rights yet. And there are any number of reasons for that. But the reasons come back to what makes us valuable. So the only difference between a mere human and a person in this case, because I would not actually separate those two things, would be a question of value. So the question there is, what's the difference? And whatever they name will typically end up being some kind of a functional trait, some kind of way of separating the person from the body, right? Which is a whole other interesting philosophical view of what it means to be human. And so there it's, why is it that thing that grants us value and not something else? We named Stephen Schwartz's, the philosopher Stephen Schwartz, who did say there's no relevant difference between embryos and us. And he said the only areas of difference you can point out are size, embryos are tiny, level of development, they are less developed, their environment, because they're located in a different place, and their degree of dependency. They're dependent on their mothers for survival. All of those things are true. That's the famous SLED acronym, S-L-E-D.
Which I've always credited to Scott Klusendorf.
Well, he modified it.
Oh, good. There it is.
Yeah. So
that's where
fine.
I read it. Yeah.
That's fine. But Stephen Schwartz was the original. He coined it. So I think when we look at those differences, we can see that if we're going to base our value on something like size, for example, embryos are tiny, therefore they're insignificant, someone might say. Well, if size is the value-giving function or trait, then that creates a value spectrum. Because that would mean that tiny human beings matter less than larger human beings, which is a whole world of trouble, you know, when we're supposed to protect the most vulnerable among us. So I think that when we start to point out that any kind of functional difference, because traits and attributes, abilities, functions, those things come to us in varying degrees. If you can start to point out that spectrum that it creates, no matter what the person names, then we can see that these types of answers have no grounding for equality, not ultimately, and that actually the Christian view, which would agree with this philosophical view that intrinsic value is the thing that makes most sense, the fact that you matter just because you're human, that makes not only more sense, it provides grounding for human equality, and it's a much more beautiful story to tell the world about itself.
So you mentioned, I'll quote somebody else, yeah, tried off the toddler. There's also, you know, daddy, can I kill it?
Yeah.
So what is the object being killed? You told a story about that one.
About my daughter.
Yeah, about your daughter.
Oh, yeah. That was a true story from my from my true life. Yeah. No, I talked about my friend Courtney coming over, bringing her boys, and because we're moms and we're best friends, like we were fueling up on coffee just to make it through the rest of the day. They were little at that point. So we sent the kids into the backyard. We could not see them at all. But because we're good moms, we left the door open so we could hear them, right? I tried to like make that appeal. We were sitting down to drink our coffee and I heard my daughter screaming from the backyard, like blood-curdling screaming. And so of course I dropped the coffee, which that is the most tragic part of that story.
Of course.
It is. It really was. But I didn't know that at the time. So I'm running for the door and I hear my daughter shouting, get this off me, get it off me. Just kill it. To which I'm asking myself, because you know, like as a dad, like in there, in that moment where you can't get to them yet, it's like a black hole time flux thing. Like it stretches into a small eternity. And so I'm in mid lunge thinking to myself, kill what? Mm-hmm. What is on you? You know, and so that's in the illustration where it stretches out into that. It's, you know, I'm wondering what is on her. If it's a spider, like, I'll help her kill it. If it's my dog, we're going to...
Probably not.
We're going to put him back in the... He is a healer, so he does, like, round up my children by nipping them on the legs. But that's bred into him. Then we're going to put him back in the house. If it's her brother, then we have a whole world of problems, right? At the time of this story actually happened, my husband was a pastor, and so, you know, I don't know where we go for help at that point if it's her brother. The point of all that is the answer to what is it matters. And when we're talking about this question, can we kill the unborn? We want to know first, what is it? We can't answer the question, can we kill it, until we first answer the question, what is it? And that's where the science comes in. What is the unborn? Not a religious question. Mm-hmm. It is a scientific one. And we answer that through, really, embryology has answered that consistently for a very long time, that the unborn is a living, distinct, and whole human being. And mm-hmm. there's so much that you can unpack there, too.
But. It really is. Mm-hmm. So if the unborn is a human life, then no justification for abortion is possible.
Right.
Really.
Right.
And so all of these other considerations fall flat, and it almost looks like there's a prior commitment to the position, and now we need to find a reason for it that has utility given the environment that we're in.
Yeah.
And that's a dangerous, dangerous place to be. And you know, pro-choice people aren't the only people who do self-justification constantly. You know, we do it too.
Absolutely.
For sure. Something you mentioned there, you know, we're very much exegetical people. We're at a Bible college. Mm-hmm. You know, 59% of our required classes are exegetical. And when I was in the pastorate talking about life issues, and I do think that life issues of all kinds are things to lose your life in ministry over. I think it's that important. Sometimes people would really want me to stick to scripture on it.
Yeah.
And just say, well, it's easy, that's murder, and then move on.
Yeah.
But I just don't think you can argue that way necessarily. At some point, or things like, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Well, kind of, but that doesn't really answer some of these questions or objections. So to get into a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of science, and all that stuff is on her side because it's true stuff. It's
yes.
And all the true stuff is God stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you hit it on the head when you're talking about, we can infer from scripture very clearly that to take innocent life is wrong and forbidden. And so even though the word abortion is not mentioned in the Bible per se, that's not a reason to say, oh, well, that's okay. You know, drive-by shootings aren't mentioned in the Bible either, but we're not going to advocate for those just because of that argument from silence, right?
Yes.
So when it comes to this issue, we are living in a world that for the most part has adopted a very different worldview. Their commitments are not those to scripture as ours are. And so if we're going to argue from that with someone who doesn't believe in God, therefore doesn't believe that God wrote a book, you know, yeah. I know it's more to it than that, but then that's going to be difficult for us. So I think that learning the apologetics, the evidence that's around us that God provided through his general revelation, and working our way there is helpful for some people. And what I have found is that when I have these conversations based on the science and the philosophy, I end up back at gospel conversations mm-hmm. more than any other subject matter I could touch on in the realm of apologetics.
Amen. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Same. Because it leads us back to something objective. So why do I say that this life is a precious, eternal human soul? Why do I say that? And that's all established in scripture. And if we can get them to at least interact, we can take them to what we believe. Whether they agree or not, we've been able to faithfully confess.
Yeah, and that's, I'm a Christian because I think it's true. The same
exactly.
reason that you are. And I do think that, I don't know where else you can ground that intrinsic value ultimately, other than the Imago Dei.
Yeah.
So it's going to end up back there, but you know, I pointed out earlier that Christians are not the only people who would adhere to the pro-life position. There are pro-life atheists and pro-life feminists and pro-life, you name it, they're out there. And they would argue with the same science and philosophy, I think, that the Christian worldview offers the ultimate grounding that some others may be lacking.
I just wrote next blog post is, next blog post that's going up on our website has to do with accuracy versus precision. And in systematic theology, you know, ethics and apologetics and dogmatics, and how we could have the same ethics as a Muslim, maybe for different reasons and probably wouldn't agree on anything else. But there are all kinds of pro-life people because life is precious. So I did not prepare you for this one. It just came to my mind. After dinner last night, Michelle starts laughing. My wife, Michelle, starts laughing and realized, she said, "I just figured it out. I knew I've heard her voice before." And she said, Strong Women Podcast.
Yes.
Favorite episode of so when I see Stone Street and Kunkel at ETS or something, I always say that my wife loves your wives. Doesn't really care much about you either way, but the Strong Women Podcast. Michelle said that was her favorite episode last year, Strong Women Podcast. It was on beauty, and that's the topic today, isn't it?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that at chapel.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I'm going to miss that one. Luther has a lot to say on beauty. Mark Mattis wrote a book, Martin Luther on Beauty, fantastic book, Oswald Byers, contemporary interpreter. But just give us a thumbnail of what you're going to talk about today on beauty.
Yeah, me diving into the topic of beauty, other than a background in art and storytelling, so it's always been there, but Summit actually asked me to prepare a presentation for our students there on beauty, and that was really what they gave me. Could you talk about beauty? Mm-hmm. I thought, do you have a specific question?
Yes.
But what a joy it was to just dive in and go deep into exploring, trying to understand, and I had to figure out a way to talk about beauty and its importance to 16-year-old boys, right? Because that's part of our audience at Summit. So that was a tricky one. I thought, I can't just talk about floral arrangement because I'll lose them, because there's so much more to it than that. Yeah. And so the entry into it was really thinking about beauty as how do we use beauty? And if we cultivate it, what does that mean for us as Christians? I was inspired by Andrew Peterson, who I think is actually going to be visiting this campus soon.
Friend of FLBC.
What a privilege.
Oh, my.
I was inspired by Lanier Ivester, who also writes for The Rabbit Room, and some others that I'd been reading and listening to. But the idea that when we cultivate beauty in the world around us, it's really an act of defiance against all that is dark and broken and wrong with the world. That Christians are uniquely suited because of what we can infuse the things that we do, and even the small things like using a real mug for the coffee or the strong coffee that you made last night,
right? Yeah, you can always add water.
When you do put flowers on the table, just because you didn't have to, it's something extra. And our culture views beauty as something that's extra, not really necessary for rich people, luxurious. But in reality, it is a vital aspect of the world that God made. It is real. It's not something that's just in the eye of the beholder. The Romantics did not help us with that. And we need it. And when we have it, you know, our lives are improved. Hard things become less hard in some ways. And when we understand its power and we walk in that and utilize it, I think that we begin to see that even the everyday small faithful things that really make the biggest difference in the long run have these eternal consequences and great meaning.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just reflecting on that, I'm an engineering physics basketball coach. That was my background.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I got here as a student and I started to engage more with Christian thinking and people whose lives have been transformed by Christ, I started to see the necessity of beauty. I certainly don't consider myself an artist, but it's so important. It breathes life into us to have these people around us. A good friend of mine who has since gone home to be with the Lord, I remember watching him eat a sandwich, and he ate differently than I ate. He was considering what he was doing, and it is. So I'm glad you're able to visit about that, and I'll listen to the recording.
No, we had a student at Summit, a young man who, after he heard that presentation, he came up and he said, "I'm an engineer major, and I wouldn't call myself an artist, but you've taught me that I am creative, and I didn't know that I could build bridges beautifully."
Mm.
And so we all have that capacity
within
us. It is.
That's fantastic. Oh, that's good. Okay, last item here. Recommended reading or resources there's so many. How many? We've dropped about 16 of them already.
I know.
But if our students I know are going to want to dig more, and I'll follow up in class and all that. But if a listener to this episode would like to maybe a next place to dig their teeth in, any ideas?
Yeah, when it comes to the pro-life apologetics, I started with my boss's book, and I'm not just saying it because he's my boss. He is the best of men, Scott Klusendorf, the president of Life Training Institute. But I wasn't working for him when I read the book, and it was the best diving in point to learn just the basics of the pro-life apologetic.
I would agree. That's the same thing. I don't know Scott personally, but I feel like I do because, like so many people, he's trained us, you know, indirectly.
Mm-hmm. I understand. So that is his book is called The Case for Life. The original version is fantastic. Next May, he's actually releasing a new edition with added chapters and rewritten content just to update things a little bit. But the arguments haven't changed, just addressing other arguments that have come out, especially at the academic level, which is helpful because it gives us these categories, working categories to a greater extent. I always go back to Frances Beckwith's book, Defending Life, if I want to read about the history of Roe v. Wade, or if I want to read about the argument from autonomy, particularly the one that was penned in 1971 by Judith Jarvis Thompson, the violinist analogy, which some people may or may not be familiar with, but it's probably the best version of an argument from autonomy that I know of. Others have come out since, but if you can read his take on that, then you can handle pretty much at least a conversation with anyone who might be arguing from those grounds. So I'd start there and then do what I did, follow the footnotes.
Yes.
If you want to take it to the next level, Christopher Kaiser, a good Catholic ethicist, wrote The Ethics of Abortion, and it is a meaty, wonderful, just expansive read. He is brilliant. When it comes to these other things, you just read what inspires you. I talked about Andrew Peterson.
Yes.
He wrote Adorning the Dark, and then the God of the Garden are his two kind of books on this topic. There are many, many others.
And those are not hard reads.
No, they're wonderful.
And the God of the Garden, I mean, you can't put that one down.
Mm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, yeah. You also mentioned on the theology of the body, some of the best work, all the best work that I can think of. It's Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And that should not, for Protestant people, it's a real danger to simply throw out everything Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. It's, the Trinity, right?
Okay. So, yeah.
And I think we need to be much more secure in looking at where those things overlap. And the theology of the body, excellent, necessary considerations.
Yeah. So. Christopher West, who made John Paul II's Theology of the Body very accessible, I'd start with Our Bodies Tell God's Story. Mm. But there are also some great Protestant writers who have made some contributions. I picked up Timothy Tennant's book, For the Body, I believe it's called.
I don't know that one.
Mm-hmm. So another one, and there's a couple of others, but those are great starting places.
Great. Now I need to go to our library and make sure all those things are on the shelf. So that's great. All right. Well, I think we'll call that a day. Megan, it's been great. You've done a fantastic job here. Thank you for your ministry. Thank you to your family, too. For sure. Travel's hard. It is. Even if it's enjoyable and profitable, it is hard as well. So thank you. And we give you now the honorary title that we give to many of our guests, Friend of FLBC. So thank
you. Wonderful. I'm privileged to have been here. Thank you.